Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Three years ago on Melbourne Cup Day, six-year-old Kylie Mabry walked from her Preston home to buy sugar from a shop down the street. She never returned. Her body was found the next day in a gutter. Kylie had been drugged, raped, and strangled to death. The murder case quickly went cold, but detectives never gave up hope. Last year, fresh DNA samples led police to 74-year-old Gregory Davies. He was questioned by police shortly after the murder, but escaped suspicion at the time.
Crime reporter Keith Moore spoke to us in an earlier episode of Australian True Crime about his book Crims in Grass Castles. It's about the Calabrian Mafia in Australia. But there are a number of cases that have become personal for Keith over his 30-year career. One of them is the abduction and murder of a six-year-old girl by the name of Kylie Mabry. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb, and as always, we seek to go behind the headlines to discover how people become murderers, how people become victims, and what happens next. And after 33 years, Keith Moore finally has all the answers to those questions in this case. It's a very suburban story of people growing up and then raising their own families in close-knit communities. Communities in which we think we know our neighbours. But can we ever really know what anyone else is capable of when the conditions are just right for a terrible fantasy to be carried out? We start this conversation with Keith by discussing the long period of time that this case was considered very, very cold.
Yes, it was. In fact, it was one of the ones that the cold case squad that Ron Idles formed in, you know, the early 2000s. It was one of the first cases that he decided to look at because he believed it was solvable. But, you know, you're going back nearly 33 years. Melbourne Cup Day, 1984, six-year-old girl goes to the corner shop to buy a bag of sugar, which, look, now people might think, why would you send a six-year-old girl to the corner shop? But, hey, it was different times.
Yeah, in the 1980s. Used to go to the milk bar when you
were
that age.
Exactly. She didn't have to cross any roads. It was literally just at the bottom of the street. Sadly, she never came home because some dirtbag picked her up on the way back at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and her body wasn't found until 2 o'clock the next morning. He'd held her for a number of hours.
I think about it a lot because I have 2 7-year-olds, and I think, God, when my little brother Pete in particular was my, say, little brother, he's a big unit and he's about 38 now, but I think of him as little Pete. And when he was about 5, we used to send him to the shop all the time over the road. When I was 5, I used to ride my bike up the road to buy mum smokes and Becks. I mean, and that was in the 80s as well, early 80s. You're so right. It was a different time and we gave kids more responsibility in those days.
We did, and this one particularly affected me. And look, I had become a father for the first time. My oldest boy is 33, and I was actually at the crime scene. In those days, I worked for the Herald, and the Herald's deadlines were, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning. You had to file, so we actually had a 2 a.m. till 10 a.m. shift on police rounds, working out of the old Russell Street. That's where I was. Heard about the code 69, as murders are called, on the police radio.
So that was the discovery of
went out there, and basically the body was still covered up. The homicide squad hadn't got there. A lone policeman was standing guard with the blue tape, and me and a couple of other journalists sort of stood around. And it's not that you particularly want to look, but you might have to, and you might have to report upon it. When the coroner arrived with the homicide squad, they took the blanket off, and her little body was just lying face down in the gutter, and they then turned the body over, and her little arm went flap onto the curb. And look, I didn't think it had affected me at the time, in that, you know, the adrenaline's going, you're just thinking about your deadline and what you've got to file, and will the homicide squad talk to me? And I then filed 3 or 4 times during the day, went to a press conference, got home, and my wife said, did you have to do the Kelly Mabry story? And I went, and then just burst into tears. Mm, yeah. And for months afterwards, I just could not get that, like a little rag doll, no visible signs of injury on her body at all. And to think that somebody could do that to a six-year-old, it still sends shivers down my spine even now, 32 years on.
And being a new parent, I can remember when I'd had my first daughter sitting in my flat in London, bursting into tears watching the news. I'd never done that before, but I was holding this little baby and just couldn't get over the evilness of the world.
No.
Yep.
And Kylie's mum, Julie Mabry, Did you interview her at the time, close to the time? When did you meet her?
Yes, I first met her about 4 weeks later when, and as you're probably aware, if a homicide isn't solved in the first 3 days, which is why homicide squad crews work 24 hours a day for the first 3 days, that's the crucial time. And after that, it starts to get hard. The clues go away. So the police actually wanted a burst of publicity. So I went to see Julie, did an interview and you know, I think got a double page spread. And during the course of the conversation, it turned out that we share the same birthday. She's younger than me, but May the 27th is our birthday. And she moved away to Queensland and she rang me on that first birthday to wish me happy birthday and then said, you know, I'm in Queensland. I wish I could put some flowers on Kylie's grave. I always used to on my birthday. So I said, look, I'll do that. And, you know, it became a bit of a ritual after that we would talk to each other on each birthdays. I would then interview her on the 10th anniversary, the 15th anniversary. And then there was in about 2006, they thought that Robert Arthur Selby Law, who's the pedophile that killed Cherie Beasley, you know, the little pink bicycle down there in the Mornington Peninsula and shoved her tiny little body in a drain. A lot of similarities between that murder and Kylie Mabry. He was a prime suspect. They desperately wanted his DNA because the person that raped and murdered Kylie left a lot of DNA evidence on the body and on the clothes. So they've always had they haven't always had the killer's DNA, but the killer left behind DNA. And it was just at the point in time where the government passed the law that every prisoner was going to be forced to give their DNA. Mm. And Robert Arthur Selby Law decided that he would exercise his legal rights through legal aid, and he mounted a constitutional challenge to the validity of the act in the High Court. Mm. And it was obviously going to cost a fortune for Victoria Police to fight that. So they, it's not illegal, and some people, civil libertarians, might frown upon it, but the options were, do we spend a lot of the taxpayers' money fighting this to the High Court, or do we sneakily get his DNA while he's in prison? Which is what they did. They just got a prison officer to get his hairbrush one day and they got the DNA, they tested it, and it turned out it wasn't him. He was actually just fighting it because it gave him an interest in life. So
this police, is it, because so they've got nothing else to do, some of these guys, so they litigate. So I guess the idea was that if the DNA matched, then they would go through with the fighting it in the High Court and get it legally.
Because the DNA sample, if they got surreptitious, you wouldn't have been admitted in court. But obviously what they would then have done, they would have fought it in the High Court and it would have cost a lot of money. And so it did save the taxpayers a lot of money.
Yeah.
But the DNA is crucial in this case in that in 1984, when this happened, nobody knew what DNA was. Mm. The first use of DNA anywhere around the world was still 2 or 3 years away, and it was 1989 before DNA was first used in a court case in Victoria. So nobody knew what DNA was. Thankfully, the detectives of the day and the scientists at the day thought these bodily fluids in Kylie's body and on Kylie's body and on the clothes might one day be useful. Therefore, we'll put them in this plastic bag and freeze them, which is what they did. And they lay there in a freezer for more than 10 years. It was 1985 before the technology had advanced enough that the cold case squad said, let's get lots of exhibits out of the freezer, test them for DNA, and then whack the samples on the DNA database. Mm. And they solved a lot of crimes that way, just simply by what they call a cold hit, where someone that hadn't even been a suspect in the murder, it gets solved, or the rape, just because the DNA matches. Sadly, there wasn't a match in 1985 because the killer's DNA wasn't on the database. Mm. So from that time on, they knew they had the killer's DNA, and it wasn't until 2016 when the cold case squad had a fresh look at Kylie's case. They went out and re-interviewed all the people that had been interviewed at the time, and this particular Gregory Keith Davies, who's the man that's now pleaded guilty to Kylie's murder, was one of the ones they questioned. He at the time, and no reason to think he was a suspect at the time, and that he was just one of hundreds of men that lived in the area, basically. But in 2016, he volunteered to give his DNA sample, and I suspect he volunteered because he knew that they would only have to go to a magistrate or a judge and get a warrant. So he did, and it matched, and they charged him, and that's why he pleaded guilty.
Did he know his DNA had been left or had picked up at the original time off Kylie's body? Was he thinking, I'm going to get caught, or he just had no idea that he would get matched?
You'd have to think that in this day and age, anybody, particularly that sort of a criminal, would, you know, they'll have watched CSI and they'll have read stories. So you'd have to think he would be aware of DNA, and he would have remembered what he did to Kylie and that he didn't take any precautions. Mm. There was no, you know, protection used. It was just what you'd expect a pedophile to do to a six-year-old girl when he's raping and murdering her to death. So there was, you know, there was ample DNA from the time. I think he just knew that It was him.
Who is this man, Gregory Keith Davies? Is he guilty? Has he been convicted of other crimes or?
Look, we didn't know it at the time, but yes, he's a 74-year-old man. And another story I broke during the week was in 1970, this is 14 years before he attacks Carly Mabry, he attacked a 14-year-old girl on the Hurstbridge line on a train very violently with a hammer, beat her over the head a number of times, caved her skull in. She was paralysed on one side. He was caught running away from the scene with a bloodied hammer in his Gladstone bag, and he had blood all over his clothes as well.
I seem to remember he said he was going to rape her, but the blood put him off.
That poor girl had to give evidence against him from a wheelchair. She was, you know, paralysed on one side, and he went to jail over that at the governor's pleasure, which obviously means that there was no particular sentence given because, you know, it was deemed that he had mental problems. But I've since discovered it just in the last few days that according to one of the victims and some relatives, that he did offend against children both before and after Carly Mabry, and did about 2.5 years in jail for that. But I just haven't been able to get the actual criminal record checks because they're not as easy to get these days. And 10 or 15 years ago, you could just ring up and say, what is this person's criminal record? He's already pleaded guilty. But these days, you've got to put FOIs in, and even then, you might not get it. But I've certainly spoken to a very close relative of his who says the whole family is disgusted by him. There was only one brother, and he was one of 11 siblings. Only one brother stuck by him. And that brother did turn up in court for the first appearance, but the rest of the family have disowned him, basically, and horrified at his actions.
He's got a wife, hasn't he, who's a bit older than him?
She's in her 90s, yes.
And so what is she?
Nobody's been. Like, we haven't found her. Yep. We spoke to her about when he was charged a year or so ago, and not that she wanted to say very much, but she was a lot older than him. But in his community, we've spoken to people in his community, and he was a bit of a musician. He played in bands at the local clubs, and, you know, in hindsight, people are now saying, oh, we always thought there was something weird about him, but they didn't seem to at the time. He lived in the community like the rest of us. So for 32 years, he's been walking free after having committed a terrible crime like that.
And allegedly reoffending. During that time. So what led police around to him again last year?
They reopened the cold case squad, had a fresh look at it. And the first thing you do is you get, when you do a cold case, is the detectives get every bit of documentation that's there, and that they go through the IOs, which are the information reports. Now, this bloke, Gregory Keith Davies, was spoken to at the time, not because he was a suspect, but because every man within a kilometre, because he lived fairly close to both where Carly lived, and where the body was found. He lived about 500 metres away from where the body turned up in the gutter in Donald Street, Preston. And turns out he lived with his mum and his sister. But on the day that Carly was picked up, his mum and sister were staying with relatives, so he knew he had the house to himself. So presumably he took her back to the house. He must have kept her somewhere for the several hours that he had her. So he was questioned at the time. He didn't really have an alibi. He said he admitted that he'd been in the area at the time, and that he had driven past where Carly would have been at about 5:30, but then he'd gone straight home and he was there by himself. And so he didn't have an alibi. He didn't have anybody to say, you know, he was with me then. He couldn't have done it. Mm. But there wasn't anything to put him high up on any suspect list. So, you know, it's very easy in hindsight to say, gee, they missed it there. And look, I'm sure the detective that actually questioned at the time is probably thinking, oh, no, if only I'd... Because we now know that he had a criminal record. We know that in 1970 he went to jail for bashing a 14-year-old girl. So I can only presume, and I don't know, because that the homicide squad, quite rightly, aren't helping journalists at present. Mm. They want to get not just the sentence out of the way, but the 28-day appeal period. So it's right. Difficult to get the exact facts, because basically they're not giving interviews and they're not telling anybody. But you would have to think that had the detectives at the time done a criminal record check on him and found out that he'd served time for beating a 14-year-old girl over the head, maybe they would have gone back and questioned him a bit harder. Mm. Now, it's very easy for me to say that, but, you know, it's the detective that knocked on his door had probably spoken to 14 people that day. In those days, it wasn't a case of sitting at your terminal and keying into the leap. You would have had to have gone to where the criminal records are checked in a drawer, and you would have had to pull it out. And you know, it's quite labour-intensive. Not excusing it, because, of course, you should do absolutely everything.
He probably wasn't even the only man who didn't have an alibi. I mean, his story just sounds like a reasonable story.
Yes. So it was basically, it was, you know, the dedication by the Cold Case Squad and Victoria Police for never giving up, that they very diligently went through and spoke to a lot of the original people that were spoken. And the obvious thing to do is ask every one of them to give a DNA sample, and they did. I mean, they took DNA samples from not just this man, but quite a few others, and because they knew they had the killer's DNA, and it is just such a testament to the wonders of science that DNA not only got their man, but made him plead guilty and saved everybody the cost of a trial, saved the mother having to get in the witness box because she was very nervous about doing that. So, you know, that's down to DNA and the diligence of the Cold Case Squad.
Was there a call during that reinvestigation, like a lead from the public or a tip-off about him?
There was a press conference given by the Homicide Squad a few months before he was actually charged, where they wanted witnesses to come forward that might have seen a station wagon, a white station wagon, which was the vehicle that he drove at the time. And they wanted a couple of people who'd called Crime Stoppers years back and said that they'd seen this car at a particular time. So, yes, there was an appeal for help, and there was, as I understand it, some more helpful information to Crime Stoppers, but it was really the DNA swab, the old, you know, cotton bud in the mouth on his cheek, and that's what got him.
I'm just reading here that Julie Mabry, Kylie's mum, realised that she knew the family, the Davies family, that she had visited the house, she'd met the mum. I mean, it was a small community.
That was one of the most bizarre things, and that the circumstances for that were, after he was charged, everybody, and up to then, at that point, nobody knew that he had any priors, but common sense suggests pedophiles, their first offence isn't normally rape and murder.
Mm.
They normally build up to things like that. And, you know, so it was, you know, your antenna goes, you think he's got to have done other things. Mm. And I was about to start trying to find that out when I got contacted by a relative who said, why didn't your story say how close Keith Davies lived to where the body was? I said, I didn't know. Where did he live? So I was given the address and I went out to the house and I took a picture of the house. And I went to see Julie with this new information. And I said, oh, you know, I've had a call from a relative of the bloke that was charged. And he lived only 500 metres from the house. And I pulled the photograph out and showed it to her. And she just burst into tears and said, I've been to that house. I knew the mum. And I said, what do you mean you've been to the house? She said, a girlfriend of hers, when she was about 12 or 13, was going out with one of the Davies boys. And as I say, there was 11 of them, big family. And Julie used to go to the house with her girlfriend. And she doesn't know whether she ever met Gregory Keith Davies or not, but she certainly met his mum, and she might have met him. She said there was boys in the house. Mm. And it really does show you how eerie things can be. And it really, really disturbed her that she'd spent time in the house of the man that ended up raping and murdering her daughter.
Oh, my God, it's unbearable. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we hear more about the aftermath of Kylie's death for the surviving members of her family, including, of course, her mum Julie, who had this to say after hearing Gregory Davies plead guilty to murdering her daughter.
And I'm so totally over the moon that he's done it. It's really good. The joke call will be over very shortly, and we all can live our lives again.
There were some twists and turns during over the years, weren't they, with this case? Some red herrings, would you call them? Can you talk about any of those?
Well, look, particularly in the months afterwards, there was a number of weird things. Like, there was this massive Greek urn, and I'm talking about an urn that's like half the size of me, that suddenly appeared on Kylie's grave. And you know, some words in Greek, and Kylie's mum was mortified when she found that and wondered whether it was a clue. There was also on the side of the CUB building, there was, you know, her name was up there, and, you know, this is the suspect, and so we got
like graffiti,
a number of graffiti, you know.
Oh. So,
and you know, who knows what it meant? I think Milo or Miley, there was something about Miley, Kylie Mabry, Miley's the man, something like that was written in huge letters. So there was a number of things that kept it in the public eye, but by far the biggest was when Robert Arthur Selby Law became the prime suspect. And I've spoken to Homicide Squad detectives that said, were it not for DNA, he would have been charged and probably convicted, in that there was the strawberry shortcake handbag that Kylie was carrying. A one was found fairly close by. He was a travelling, this is Robert Arthur Selby Law, was a travelling salesman, and he frequented the Preston area. There was a couple of witnesses, two girls who were 11 and 12 who lived very close to Carly, that told police that Robert Arthur Selby Law stopped them in the street one day when they were in their school uniform. So there was like 8 or 9 different things that pointed to Law being the killer of Carly. And because, thank God, it is incredibly unusual for pedophiles to pick children at random off the street and then murder them. I mean, thank God it doesn't happen very often. Mm. Most of that type of offences are within the family, and usually there's not the sort of violence that leads to murder involved. So thankfully, this sort of offender is really rare. And when we knew that Robert Arthur Selby Law had already done that to another young girl, Cherie Beasley, Homicide Squad were hot to trot. They were convinced they'd got their man, and just couldn't believe it when the DNA came back that it wasn't him.
And so, Julie had her hopes really built up, didn't she, about it?
And that was over a number of months, in that he as I say, he was brought into court, and you know, they were trying to force him to take his DNA, but because the act was fairly new. So over a number of months, he had appearances in court, and in the end, as I say, he was going to go right to the High Court. And that's when Victoria Police said, this is going to cost too much money when there's a chance it's not him. And that's when they surreptitiously got his DNA. Mm.
So I didn't know about the 28-day. What's the 28-day period now after he's pled guilty?
After he's sentenced.
Oh, okay.
After anybody's sentenced, there is then a 28-day appeal period where the person can appeal against not just the conviction, but the sentence.
Okay.
Basically, any journal trying to get help from police, like, what other offences has he done? Can I speak to the Homicide Squad detective who was involved to try and answer all of these questions that are floating in all of our collective minds? I've found in the last 5 or 6 years that it's almost impossible to speak to any of those people or get that information until after the 28-day appeal period. And their argument is, and look, their priority isn't getting stories in the Herald Sun or you know, radio interviews. Their priority is ensuring that person is found guilty, convicted, and doesn't win an appeal. So, you know, they're basically playing it by the rules, in that there is a chance that within that 28 days he might appeal against the length of his sentence, for example, which would mean that
this is why,
if he wins, and
this is why we end up with this sort of sudden cavalcade of information about somebody a little while afterwards. Do you expect that? Are you expecting a lot of information to come to light?
Look, I don't know how much more will, but I was surprised just in with a couple of days that I spoke to, you know, one of his victims, found out about another of his victims, and spoke to a relative who gave me more information about him. So,
did the relative contact you?
Yes.
Does that happen often?
Look, it depends on the story. In that, it wouldn't if the relative was still friendly with him.
Yes.
But you know, thankfully, everybody in his family, other than one brother, I'm led to believe, basically disowned him as soon as they knew what he was up to. And look, he's obviously been doing it for a heck of a long time. There are presumably others, and it may well be others come out of the woodwork.
Because you presume they wouldn't just offend once or twice and that's it.
Yes, this sort of offender normally, you know, starts off small and builds up and gets more and more serious, because it's an addiction that they don't normally just stop unless they're in jail or they die. Mm.
Did you think at any stage this case was unsolvable? It's such a, like, a lot of people know about the Kylie Mabry case and remember the front pages. And did you think this was not going to get solved at any point?
Look, I did, and Julie and I have spoken about it regularly. After the Robert Arthur Selby Law thing, I mean, she was convinced, I was convinced, the homicides were convinced that it was him, particularly when he didn't volunteer his DNA, when he decided to, you know, fight it to the, you know, it was like 13 months after the first asked for his DNA before, you know, because it was going through that legal process. And we now know that he was just doing it to be vindictive.
He obviously knew
it wasn't him, and he's in jail. He gets legal aid, doesn't cost him anything. It's a day out. He gets ferried into, you know, relieves the boredom, just shows what an awful animal he is. I think when the DNA sample came back and it wasn't him, and Julie found out it wasn't him, I think we both thought, no, after all this time, it is incredibly unusual for crime to be solved nearly 33 years after it happened.
There's a bit of a, there seems to be a few of those happening at the moment, doesn't there? I'm careful not to mention any that are in train, but yeah, it just seems to be there's been a few lately. I hope that gives people hope that.
Well, I was just thinking that too, about people we've spoken to who are, have these sorts of crimes in their family unsolved from a long time ago. And also, this was feels like kind of a spate of horrible. I mean, you say it's really uncommon for this sort of thing to happen, for offenders to abduct strangers' children they don't know. But in 1991, Cherie Beasley was abducted and murdered. This is the one that you're talking about, by Robert Lowe. And then there was the Mr. Cruel abductions.
Yeah, that was 1988. Sharon Wills was the first one, and Mr. Cruel, as he was called, who's never been caught.
Still unsolved.
Kept her for 18 hours before he dropped her off. And then Nicola Linus was the next of his victims, kept her for 50 hours before he dropped her off. And his third and last victim was Carmen Chan in 1991. And she didn't survive. And I've spoken to Carmen's mom, and Carmen's mom believes that the reason the other two girls survived and she didn't is that Carmen was very feisty and probably pulled his mask off, and that the other two girls have given their evidence to police that they never saw his face. They were either masked or he was the whole time he had them. So therefore they couldn't identify him. Whereas of course, once Carmen Chan had seen his face, he knew that he could be exposed as Mr. Cruel, and shot her in the back of the head.
Is there any DNA evidence in that case available?
There isn't. Mr. Cruel was before his time, in that it is obviously very difficult to commit that sort of crime against three victims that have been named. There are other victims that haven't been named, but they're the three that have been named, and not leave some sort of physical presence of yourself on it. And yet he managed it. He was meticulous about bathing the girls before he dumped them off. Sharon Wills was actually dressed in green garbage bags when he dropped her off near her home in Ringwood. And that was because he obviously didn't want her clothes to go back with her in case something of him was on those clothes. So whoever Mr. Cruel is was pretty au fait with DNA and other forensic evidence to make sure it wasn't left behind. So it'd be very difficult to prove who Mr. Cruel is unless there's a confession, because there's no physical evidence to identify him.
And those crimes stopped suddenly, didn't they?
Carmen Chan was the last one, and there are various schools of thought in that they always hated the term Mr. Cruel, and it was newspapers, it was the Herald, the Sun, as it was before it became the Herald Sun, that coined the phrase Mr. Cruel. You know, we always like to have various, you know, Mr. Stinkies of this world and Mr. Cruel, and it fitted because he'd used the word cruel, and the police used the word cruel in the press comments. But the police hated it because, from what the two girls told him, he actually wasn't cruel. Now, obviously what he did was cruel, but he was actually quite gentle, and he gave them food, and he was nice to them, and he called them nice names like Missy. And the minute you start calling him Mr. Cruel, everybody obviously thinks of, you know, the worst monster you can imagine coming out of some X-rated shop in a dark raincoat. And he probably wasn't like that. He was probably like your next door neighbour. Maybe puts your rubbish bins out when you're on holiday. That's why the police always hated the Mr. Cruel tag, because it might have stopped somebody picking up the phone who thought, gee, well, that couldn't be him, because he's really nice to that lady next door.
Yeah, he's not cruel.
Exactly. So, you know, I feel a bit guilty that the Mr. Cruel tag stuck. But yes, the school of thought is that because he was gentle with the other two victims, he probably didn't want to kill Carmen Chan, and doing so maybe shocked him into thinking, I can't do this again, and you know, maybe he now jumps on an aeroplane and flies to Cambodia or the Philippines for a holiday every now and then.
That for my generation in Melbourne, that's like the case we still talk about. People want to know about, you know, what's happening. I sometimes get emails, I'm sure you get a lot of emails from people, you know, wondering if he was a teacher because of when he offended, or if he was like a lab assistant, or just interesting little things.
Because of his knowledge of
DNA
and stuff like
that.
The
time frame that he would offend was school holidays.
They were nearly all school holidays. And you're quite right. It just changed the way, it changed the way what you let your children do, in that, you know, it was the start of people thinking.
Well, between those three abductions, those three cases, absolutely.
Yeah, little, that was like Cherie over a 3-year period, you know, 1988 and 1991. There was a lot of fear right there in the community, because, you know, it's obviously every parent's worst nightmare is that your kid's going to go out to school or to get a 2-pound bag of sugar from the corner shop and not come home.
Was that one of your biggest cases of your career? That it sort of, how does it feel to see it go from beginning to end?
Look, it is. There aren't many that I've physically been at the murder scene and then, you know, nearly 33 years later been in court when that man has pleaded guilty. It was a very rewarding and moving moment. As I said, having seen Carly's body and sharing a birthday with Julie, and, you know, she's not just somebody I interview now. She's somebody that, you know, leans on me for support every now and then, and we help each other out where we can. It was enormously rewarding to hear that guilty plea. I was just praying that it wasn't going to be a not guilty and it was going to drag on for 18 months. And then, you know, he might get off for whatever reason. You know, he might be able to query the DNA evidence. But fortunately, he's done the honourable thing and saved us all from the cost of a trial and the trauma of a trial for Julie.
What can you tell us about Julie's life subsequent to this crime?
Yeah, look, Julie
did
it hard.
Queensland?
Julie did it hard. She did live in Queensland for a while. She sadly had some very bad relationships with some very bad men. She, you know, depression, went downhill, had difficulty with some of the rest of her family. She not only had to cope with the death of Kylie, but Kylie's grandfather, Julie's father, John Moss, became a suspect very early on because Julie's brother, Mark Mabry, actually nominated the police, "I think my granddad did it." And John Moss was interviewed by the police and treated as a suspect, proved that it wasn't him. He was able to prove that he wasn't there at the time. He had cast iron alibi, but there was still a lot of talk within the family and in the media and elsewhere. And John Moss decided it was too much for him and he killed himself.
Oh, no.
So you've got a dad. And then Mark Mabry, who was the uncle Mark, went on a mission to try and find who this was and used to regularly turn up at my office in the Herald and say, "Keith, there hasn't been a story about Kylie for a month, you know, can I make another plea and I would do another story?" And he became convinced that it was another particular pedophile and went looking for that pedophile. He then got into drugs and heroin in a bad way and was arrested and went to jail and he killed himself inside jail. So Julie's lost her brother through it, her father through it, and her daughter, all in the space of the first 2 to 3 years. I mean, it's no wonder Julie couldn't cope with all of that.
She looked quite frail in the photos in the newspaper, like she needs a walker. Her health's obviously
she
not
does,
been
yeah.
Great.
She's had a number of setbacks. She had a fall not too long back, which is why the walker, but she's also had a number of other medical problems. And she actually told me last week she feared that she was going to die before she saw this solved. In fact, had he pleaded not guilty, her biggest fear was that she wouldn't be around long enough to actually see him get convicted, because it would have been another 18 months probably. Yeah. Had it gone through the committal process, the justice system is so slow that it could have easily been 18 months to possibly 2 years before we had a Supreme Court trial.
I'll never get over you telling us that Donald Mackay's wife, when she was elderly, asked you to get a note to somebody in prison.
Yes.
Begging them to just tell her where the body was and that she would never say who told her or anything like that. She just, before she died, just begging for that closure, and he wouldn't give it to her.
He wouldn't, because Jimmy Baisley is the person who went to jail for conspiracy to murder Mackay. He's now out and free and living in Melbourne. He basically, at least he had the decency to write back to her. He wrote back and basically said, "I would tell you if I could, but I didn't do it, so how would I know?" Because he's maintained his innocence. He was found guilty, but he pleaded not guilty. There's certainly a lot of evidence to suggest that it was him, and as I say, he was found guilty and he's done his time. But Barbara knew that she wasn't long for this world when she got me to smuggle that letter into Jimmy Baisley in Pentridge.
So it always makes me think about that, all of the mothers, the parents, the family, the grandparents, the siblings of these unsolved murder victims whose bodies have never been found, or, you know, who are just waiting for the end before they die.
And look, you mentioned earlier about there seems to have been a number of these cases, and that is because, God bless him, Ron Idles got a scholarship to study cold cases around the world. Victoria Police didn't have a cold case squad. Basically, quite naturally, fresh and hot homicides take preference in that, you know, murder happens, they drop everything, next 3 days, they knock on doors, they do everything. And whilst in the old days it used to be in your spare time, you might have a bit of a look at some of the unsolved cases, but there was no dedicated squad doing just that. And the only way to do them properly is for me to say to you, okay, you do nothing else except look at the Kylie Mabry murder. Detectives didn't have that luxury. Detectives are very busy people. So common sense suggests nobody was really looking at the unsolved.
No.
Yes, if some new information came in, they would obviously follow it up. But what happens now, and it's through Ron Idles, he formed a cold case squad and look, it was only a very small one to start with, but since Graham Ashton was appointed Chief Commissioner, it's a real, he's really keen on giving resources to cold cases, in that he's formed a cold case sex crime squad, and he's also formed the cold case homicide squad, and that's why there are a number of old rapes and a number of old murders that are being solved, is because there now is a core of detectives who do nothing else, and usually they only look at one at a time. And that's the only way to do it properly, is to do nothing else except live and breathe that cold case.
Well, the great irony, of course, is that the first case that Ron Idle's ever investigated as a homicide detective is still unsolved. The Maria James bookshop murder.
It is. That's the one he would have loved to have solved before he went off into retirement. Not that I think Ron is really retired. I think he'll keep popping up doing things.
Well, he won't change his mobile number for one thing, so.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Keith.
Of course, that famous unsolved case of Ron Idle's is now the subject of an excellent podcast called Trace that's presented by Rachel Brown for ABC Podcasts. You can get it wherever you normally get your podcasts from. Thank you so much for downloading Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. And thank you to those who have gone to iTunes and given us nice reviews and 5 stars, and to those of you who've joined our community on Facebook. We really appreciate the encouragement.